I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. I'm joined today by Matt Parrott and author Tom Goodrich. Tom, I understand that you actually go by Mike as your middle name. Is that right?
People who know me, Greg, they call me Mike, call me Tom, call me Michael, call me Thomas.
Okay, well can we call you Tom just because that's the name that appears on the books?
That'll work.
Okay, yeah. Okay, good. Well, Tom, welcome to the show. Tom Goodrich is the author of 10 books. He's been published by university presses, the University of Nebraska, Indiana University, Kent State University. He's also been published by commercial publishers. He's a historian, and he focuses on American history, and he also has an interest in war, and not specifically so much with war as the aftermath of war. So, Tom, I understand you've written a book on the occupation of the South after the end of the Civil War, that you're writing a book about the occupation of Japan, and your ninth book, one of your most recent ones, is called Hellstorm, The Death of Nazi Germany, 1944 to 1947. Let's begin by talking about Hellstorm, because that's really the book that, well, that was the first book of yours that I came across, and I've read that book, and it made a tremendous impression on me. So why don't you tell us a bit about Hellstorm and how that book came about and what you think the significance of it is?
Okay, first, Greg, let me say this, though. I've got to take this opportunity to thank you personally for lighting a fire under my keister. When the book first came out, Hellstorm, that is, I was all set to do a lot of publicity. I thought the people who had reviewed my other books, who had had me on radio interviews, would be more than willing to jump all over this. I was, of course, was wrong. The books they talked about and reviewed weren't nearly as controversial as this. But long story short, I was sort of left there all dressed up with nowhere to go, you might say. But for about a year, I did virtually nothing with the book. Whatever it did on its own. It was only when I read in Countercurrents on the website a wonderful, heartfelt, emotional review by J.A. Sexton. That's what kicked me off the pity potty, so to speak. It was so graphic, so heartfelt, so powerful that I thought, man, what am I doing with this? I mean, if it touches somebody like this, and so eloquently, too, I must say, that I've got to do whatever it takes. And that's when I finally started coming up with these ideas. Why not go with alternative radio, revolution radio, if you will? And I really didn't realize how many outlets there were out there. Needless to say, over the last 6 months, I've been gainfully employed talking on radio, revolution radio. But back to you guys, I just want to thank you, first and foremost, for providing that outlet for Mr. Sexton, and for basically getting me moving on this thing. Countercurrents, by the way, it's one of my favorite websites. I consider it the spiritual, intellectual, if you will, epicenter of white nationhood worldwide. I cannot believe the curiosity and the honesty of the people who write in it. Anyway, again, I want to thank you for everything you've done for this book. But back to this book and the books I've written prior to this, you're right. I do have a fascination with war. I'm not so sure it's about the blood and guts itself as it is war and what has been said about it. Better yet, what has been lied about it. And that's where I come in. I've always smelled rats, so to speak. Everything from the Civil War, the Indian Wars out on the High Plains, of course, to World War II here. I always knew that the winners write history. And the losers, of course, they get vilified, denigrated, and cast into the bin of ignominy after the war. And so I think that's what I was put on this earth for, Greg, is to basically smell the rats and then write about what really happened, all the way from the American Civil War, the Lincoln assassination as well. But World War II, never have there been greater lies told than about our World War II. And, of course, the Allies were the victors in that case, and for the last 70 years, we've got nothing but lies. When they do talk about it, it's, well, let me say this. What World War II, what it is to me, was the greatest crime in history. Nothing, it even comes close to this. So many large crimes are committed in this war, and I think almost as terrible as the crimes committed against the defeated Germans and their allies is the crime of the last 70 years of silence. Nothing's been said about this. It's been hushed up. It takes someone like me with a rather small book to come out and cast some light upon it. Whereas in the past, I had cast very small, as you might say, on some subject matters, the Civil War, the Indian Wars, Abraham Lincoln. This is a large spotlight. This is the only book available that is all-encompassing, that brings in all the numerous crimes committed by the Allies against the Germans into one book. Some folks, bless their hearts, have gone to task and talked about various aspects of this greatest crime in world history, as I call it. But this book, Hellstorm, brings it all together, the enormity, the totality, the criminal nature, and that's where I go with this book. Basically, I itemize. Let me say this. I do it in the words of the folks themselves. You know, people might kill me, but it's pretty hard to kill the folks who are actually doing the talking in this book, the people who were raped 100 times without stop, the people who escaped the inferno of Hamburg and Dresden and Berlin and every other German city after the firebombing of the Allies, the people who suffered torture, had their testicles smashed, had their teeth knocked out at the end of the war by Americans. It's pretty hard to dismiss people when they're talking in their own words about what happened to them. I don't know if I'm answering your question.
No, you're giving us a very clear picture of what it's about and the passion behind it. What are the, say, three or four main areas that these crimes fall into? You mentioned the firebombings, you mentioned rapes, you mentioned torture. Can you just sort of hit on some of those major areas for our listeners?
Yeah, I think the devastation wrought by the American 8th Air Force and the British RAF against the German cities may be the greatest crime in world history. If you had to nail one, if you had to say this is A, because it was so massive, so deliberate, and so lied about afterwards. This was a deliberate attempt to kill every man, woman, and child below them, below where the bombs fell, in these cities. And in the late stages of the war, virtually the only people remaining in these towns were the old men, women, and children, and the disabled German soldiers. Most of the young men, of course, were off on the Eastern Front or the Western Front. And yet, this continued to the end of the war, this massacre from above. That is certainly a great war crime. Probably the mass rape. Now, this is my this is the thing I hate the most about the crimes committed by the Allies, was the deliberate attempt to destroy German womanhood spiritually, in some cases physically, of course, but spiritually, to take them for your own. For instance, Ilya Ehrenberg, a Jewish propagandist in the Soviet Union, one of the most read publicists in the Soviet Union, when the Soviet Union, when the Soviet troops first became got ready to break into Germany in the autumn of 1944. Ilya Ehrenberg was ready to go. He sent out broadsides, pamphlets to flutter down on the front lines after they were dropped out of airplanes, encouraging the Red soldiers to do their absolute worst once they got into Germany. This is a quote. "Kill them all, the men, the old men, children, and the women, after you have amused yourself with them. Kill. Nothing in Germany is guiltless, neither the living nor the yet unborn. Break the racial pride of the German women. Take her as your legitimate booty. Kill, you brave soldiers of the victorious Soviet Army. Kill." Now, that's just one example of Ilya Ehrenberg and his venom. You can see where it's directed. It's directed as much at the women as anything else. But he sent many, many more of these pamphlets fluttering down, these leaflets, these flyers. Of course, the young Soviet soldier, when he read things like that, he already hates the Germans because, number one, he may have destroyed their village when they came through, or he may have lost a good friend, whatever. And so he's already filled with hatred. And when you encourage an unsophisticated person like that to do their damn level best worst, that's not very good. But anyway, he will. Generally, 9 times out of 10, he will. I was in the military once. I know what soulless characters are running loose there, some really desperate people, quite honestly. And so when they did get into Germany, Russian soldier went crazy, raping women. And I must say this, a lot of the worst of the raping was done by the rear echelon, which it's always been that way, as far as I know. It's always the supply side or the rear echelon, the B team, so to speak, who comes in. The shop troops are way too busy worrying about survival to be doing all sorts of mischief like stealing and raping and murdering. They did a lot of that, but not like the second echelon. These were Mongolians. These were the Asiatics. And everybody, including the Russian officers themselves, warned the people about the second line of troops coming through. I'll talk about that a little bit more. I just wanted to set the stage with this rape. It was pervasive. It was massive. It was violent. It was vicious.
And it was policy. It was Soviet policy. That's the thing that's most extraordinary.
Well put. The penis was another weapon, just like the weapon, these rifles that the Soviet soldier carried. Then we talked, I did a little piece for your beautiful website on the expulsion of roughly 11 million Germans who lived either in the eastern provinces, the Silesia, Pomerania, Prussia, or they lived in the German enclaves of various middle, central European countries like Czechoslovakia, Hungary. The expulsion, the deliberate expulsion of roughly 11 million folks, and the consequent death of about 2 million people, who's counting? But anyway, that's also a high crime, and no one's ever been brought to account for that, turning 11 million people out of their homes, sometimes with only a few minutes warning, into the dead of winter. And as you might imagine, people perish by the thousands, the tens of thousands, the hundreds of thousands, and by the millions. That's another high crime. But, Greg, we could throw a dart at a wall and come up with a war crime committed by the Allies. Interestingly enough, the same crimes that the Allies pointed to the Germans and said, yes, you did this. This is what they did to the Germans. I find it a really nifty bit of projection to turn it back around on the vanquished of the victors. Anyway, there are many other things. For instance, the world's largest nautical massacre. A lot of folks think the Titanic. You know, I just saw something last night. It seems like they never get tired of talking about the Titanic, and for good reason. It's full of drama and pathos, and it stirs something in our stomachs when we think about a cold night at sea and hitting an iceberg and the ship sinking, and it does something to us. But how many people have heard about the Baltic Sea Massacre at the end of the war, in which countless refugee ships were sunk, deliberately, I might say, by Soviet submarines and American and British bombers. These are not warships. These are sometimes they're converted steamers, passenger ships that Hitler had used for his workers during the 1930s to send them on cruises. These were taken by the German authorities and filled with refugees to escape the Soviet juggernaut, the onslaught from the east. And everyone heard of the Titanic, rightly so, and the Lusitania, probably. But how many people have ever heard of the Wilhelm Gustloff or the Cap Arcona or the Goya or on and on and on? In the first named ship, the Wilhelm Gustloff, 7,000 women and children, almost entirely women and children, drowned after it was sank by a Soviet submarine on a very cold, icy Baltic Sea one night. Same with the Goya. About 4,000 or 5,000 people died there, dwarfing the numbers of the Titanic and the Lusitania, 1,500 and 1,200. Robert Ballard, he's one of our great explorers. Let's face it, I'm so happy and excited that he found the Titanic and has done so much with it. But hey, I'm telling you this, up in the Baltic, there's a lot of greater disasters than that and much closer to the surface. It wouldn't take that much to go down and explore and find these ships with the holes in their sides from the Soviet Soviet torpedoes. Of course, that would be not be politically correct to go down and find these skeletons, these men, women, and children at the bottom of their pathetic possessions that they took with them. That is a horror story, this slaughter at sea. It's just another facet of this, this abomination that I call World War II, this crime, this great crime against a people that, and we're talking civilians here, you know, the Geneva Convention, it's a dead letter. Let's face it. It sounded nice. They got together. Men wanted to regulate war because it was getting out of hand. But World War II, take that for example, terror bombing to kill as many civilians as they possibly could, targeting as civilians, the wholesale massacre of civilians, rape as a weapon of war on a massive scale. And by the way, when I talk about rape, this isn't just the Soviets. This is the Americans and the Brits and the French. The Americans, as one sergeant said, we're also an army of rapists. And other soldiers said, boy, would the folks back home would their toes curl and horror if they knew what we did over here. And what they're talking about is rape. Yes, maybe not as pervasive and violent as the Russians, because as often as not, a Russian soldier was as likely to kill his victim, the rape victim. But it still nevertheless happened on the Western Front. The torture, the beastly and pervasive torture that occurred after the war in the American torture pens. I don't even have to mention the ones in the Polish and Russian zones, because these are so fiendish and horrible it's hard to recite some of the things that occurred there. But the Geneva Convention, if you can get away with doing these crimes, committing these crimes as the Americans, British and French, and the Allies were or did, what good is a piece of paper? The Geneva Convention, the rules of land warfare. They tried the Germans after the war, of course, for breaking the sacrosanct laws of the Geneva Convention, but the Allies had committed 10 times the number of crimes and killed probably 1,000 times more of the victims. And nobody went to jail on the Allied side for breaking one of the Geneva Convention laws. I could go on about the crimes. The crimes, of course, Operation Paperclip, the idea of basically stealing a country's wealth, their physical wealth. The Russians took, when the war was over, took down to the last bolt the German factories and moved them by rail east, whereas the Americans stole the brain power, the scientists, the entrepreneurs, the great economists, and brought them to America. Of course, we landed on the moon because of Wernher von Braun and his team. That's another crime. You're not supposed to do that under the Geneva Convention. I mentioned the expulsion of these folks. You can go on and on. I know I'm leaving some things out. The totality becomes so overwhelming that you become numb to the whole thing.
Well, Tom, what's the sort of practical cash value for present-day politics and present-day society for bringing this side of the war to light? Because the Second World War, of course, was a good war, people say. It was a righteous war. The people who fought it were our greatest generation and so forth. And the Second World War, because it is this good war, is always being used as the analogy for starting every new war or intervention that the United States gets involved in. So for me, at least, revisionism about the causes and the prosecution and the consequences of the Second World War is absolutely indispensable for peace. We're never going to be able to shut up the warmongers or trump the warmongers in America today unless we do some work to demythologize the Second World War.
Very well put, Greg. I agree with you. You know, this war, World War II, was so vicious, so violent, so evil. It was anything but a good war, of course. We know that, and I'm sure many of your listeners already know that. It was such a terrible war, the worst war in world history, that there should have never been another war after that. The price was so horrible. I really do believe, had the people of the world known what took place, that they would have, with a unified voice, said, never again. And I'm talking about what happened to the Germans, the vanquished, after the war. I think they would have said, never again. This is just too much. These horrors will never, ever be perpetrated ever again, not in our lifetime. But that's the problem with this whole thing, the book itself. This is the only book, the first book, the only book. People didn't learn from the history because no one told them about the history. 70 years have gone by. And I dare say there's a few things that I'm saying right now that you may not have even known, Greg, although that may be a stretch, but some of your listeners for sure. And I guarantee in the book itself there'll be plenty that they've never heard about and probably didn't want to hear about, quite honestly. But if we don't know about our history, I know it's an old maxim, if we don't learn from our history, we're doomed to repeat it. And right now we're repeating it. You know, in my opinion, the Muslims of the 21st century are simply the Germans of the 20th century. They're getting the same treatment, and the same usual suspects are administering the treatment right now. We did not learn from that history because we did not know about that history. That's what this book is about. Agreed. It's a small book. It'll probably never get to be a big book. But with people like you, your help, and others, maybe enough people, maybe enough mind-molding people will learn about this and say, hey, my vote is against war for the rest of eternity. We will stop it. It'll never happen again. And that's where I come in. If I never write another damn book in my life, this is the one I'm sticking with. And I refuse to be quiet. I will not shut up. You're talking about, you mentioned to preface your question about the monetary value or the economic side of it. I'm not seeing any of that. I would, of course, love to get rich telling the truth. But that's incidental. That's secondary right now. It's secondary to my nature.
Well, I was sort of being metaphorical, talking about the political cash value, the effect that it's going to have on the world today. Let's just repeat the title again. The title is Hellstorm, The Death of Nazi Germany, 1944 to 1947. It was published in 2010 by Aberdeen Books. That is available through Amazon.com globally, I would imagine. You also have copies. Do you want to give information on how people can order this?
Yes, unfortunately, it is not available globally on Amazon. It ends right here at our borders. UK doesn't have it, or anyone else, as far as I know. The object, let me say this first, Greg, the object is to sell out the publisher, a bold, intrepid publisher, by the way, who took this book, is to sell out his hardback inventory, which I think is 500 or 600 left, so that we can do an inexpensive, accessible paperback, and above all, a Kindle version of this. And as you mentioned, the publisher is Aberdeen Books. The book can be ordered through him, the publisher out there, a small press, maybe one or two people. At the phone number is 303-795-1890. And like I said, every book you buy hardback is another, it's another book closer to doing a cheap paper and a very affordable Kindle, by the way. If I have my say about it, the Kindle will be somewhere around $7, so that's going to be nice. Yeah, they can order it through Amazon. I think it's $39. They'll send it the following day. You can get it in one day from Amazon, which is lovely, but I can't even do that. Or you can order it through me. I've got some paperback. I keep getting paperback. I've been on other radio programs, and I've told people I only had 5 left or 10, whatever. And the publisher had held back a cache of paperbacks for publicity's sake that never happened, of course, the publicity. And so now I'm buying them from him out of my royalty. I don't think I'll ever see a royalty check from this, but that's where I'm getting some now. So I do have some of those. I'm selling for $25. That's postage included. Anybody who wants to buy one of those, or the hardback, which I also have for $35, just drop the money in my PayPal bucket. My PayPal ID mtgoodrich@aol.com. That's M as in Michael, T as in Thomas, Goodrich, like the tire, @aol.com. That's also my email address. And so you can email me any of your thoughts, any questions you might have or any concerns about the book. The book's really, let me say this, the book is a, I hesitate to call it beautiful, because nothing this gory and graphic and grim is beautiful. It's a quality book, very well done, very well edited too, I've got to say. And it's about 400 pages, fully annotated. This is not, let me say this also, Greg. I've been writing history for quite a while. That's the gene I have in me, the history gene. I've never had a notion to write fiction. There's just too much good history out there, truth, that is. When I write a history book, unlike my interviews as I'm doing now and I've done in the past, where I can let her fly, the history book is not where I do that. I try to basically tell a story, a historical subject, as honestly and objectively and as neutrally as I possibly can. This is not polemics. This is not propaganda. This is not an attempt to sway people. I'm basically just letting the truth lay out there. And if you want to take it, take it. If you don't, if you want to close the book, well, then go join the mob back out there, the herd that really is terrified of the truth. And so if you think by buying this book you're going to be getting me and my ranting and raving, it's not going to happen. Like every other book, I've never been criticized for being biased in a book. I take that back. I wrote a book on the precursor to the American Civil War, and John Brown is in it. And by the way, it may seem strange to some of your listeners, I have a high admiration for many of the things that John Brown did. He was an activist. He got off his ass. He did things. He fought for what he believed in. He actually died for what he believed in. But I'm also a critic of John Brown. I mean, who goes around chopping up people into little bitty pieces? He's a fanatic, a nut job in many ways. And some people did not like my even-handed approach of John Brown, just like Lincoln. Some people don't like my portrait of Abe Lincoln or Mary Todd. Hey, that's history. Get used to it. There's the good and the bad. And that's the same thing with Hellstorm here. Now, I will say that there is no attempt on my part in Hellstorm to present the other side of this, the Allied side, that is. That, if you want that side, you just turn on the TV or go see a movie. Or better yet, go to the library and see one of the thousands of copies they've got there on the Good War scenario, the Greatest Generation. This is not that. There's not enough room in this book. This is basically what the war looked like through the eyes of the Germans, the defeated, the men, the women, the children, and mostly the civilians, I've got to say, even though there is some fighting on the Eastern Front, ferocious stuff, and then the fighting on the West Front until the final climactic Battle of Berlin takes place. This is mostly about civilians and how they escaped, how they got along, how they didn't escape, how they were killed and murdered. So with that said, that's where the book's at right now. And really, let me say this too also, Greg, and I've said this before, and I think it bears repeating. I've never been the same person since I've written this book. The book changed me. You cannot write a book, a 400-page book, and then rewrite it and write it again and think about it night and day. And then, of course, the research that you've done, you become a part of the book. You are the book. It is you. I've never been the same since I wrote this book. But I can say this. Anyone who reads this book, and bless their hearts if they do, but anyone who can read this book and then puts it down, puts it up on the bookshelf to gather dust and does nothing, in my opinion, they are complicit to the crime they've just read about. Anyone who reads this and does nothing, says nothing, is no better than an accessory to the crime. What I want people to do is read this book and then read it again if necessary. Read it until you understand every evil aspect of this, what was done in our name to these helpless people after the war, during and after the war. There is no excuse any longer. Once you know the truth, then it's up to you to do something. Acquiescence, silence is acquiescence, in my opinion. I refuse to be complicit in the crime, and I refuse to remain silent. Although these beastly atrocities were committed before I was even born, I still feel a sense of responsibility. I know what happened, and so it's my job to tell other folks what happened. And that's what this book is about. And that's what great programs like yours are about, basically to spread the word.
Well, thank you. I think that everybody who goes through a war breathes a great sigh of relief the day the armistice is signed, and most people don't realize that much of the killing in wars happens after the peace has officially been declared. That certainly happened to the Germans and the people in Central Europe at the end of the First World War. It happened in Germany at the end of the Second World War. It happened in the South after the end of the Civil War, and it happened to the Japanese as well. I understand you're doing a book about Japan in the aftermath of the Second World War. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I can talk a bit about it. And of course, it was what happened to the Germans in the Eastern Theater of Operations happened with spades to the Japs in the and I say Japs. The working title of the book is called "Dirty Japs," but it happened to the Japanese in the East. Unlike the Germans, it was despite the ferocious, vicious anti-German propaganda, it was still kind of a hard sell, because I'm part German. Despite the name Goodrich, I am part, about a half German. 50 million of us in America are part German. Those people look like us, the Germans. It's pretty hard to just slaughter in cold blood a mother who might remind you of your own mother, but it's a much easier thing to do that if they're small and slant-eyed, as the Japanese were, and if they've been demonized to the point that they're animals. As far as I know, as vicious as the propaganda against Germany was, they were never demonized to the point that they were cloven-footed animals. The Japanese were monkeys, of course. Let me say this. The genesis for the book, of course, is the Hellstorm book, the book we're talking about right now. But I can still remember as a kid, me and my cousin, I was an only child, but loved my cousin like a brother. But I can still remember on Saturdays watching the Dirty Jap movies from the 1940s and early 50s. And what a joy I got whenever old John Wayne, whoever, blew a Jap out of a palm tree, which he happened to be sneakily hiding in. And I grew up hating the Japanese, fearing them and hating them at the same time. It was only later in my life, when I got around the world quite a bit, that they're some of the best people on earth, the Japanese. I'm serious. I'm very serious about that. They really are the Prussians of the Orient. They are some of the finest people I've ever met in my life, some of the most honest, generous, decent, just good folks. And I don't think that was any different during World War II. I know they were a militaristic society, but nevertheless, like I said, I'm just in the research of this book right now, and the things I've already found are just make your hair stand up what happened. I had two fathers who fought in World War II. One was a biological father who fought in the Pacific. He was a Marine, an island-hopping Marine, private, I suppose, corporal. I never knew him. And the other father fought in the European theater. He was my adoptive dad. I loved them both in their own special way. But I know what my dad did now after the research of this book. I know what happened over there. They took no prisoners. When was the last time you saw any Japanese faces behind barbed wire in that war? They just weren't taking prisoners. That's the powerful price of propaganda in a nutshell. Take no prisoners. Kill the animals. And that's where the atom bombs come in. And some of the things that happened in Germany also happened in Japan. The rape, the slaughter of innocents, the killing of... most of your listeners have probably heard of the firebombing of the Japanese cities. Tokyo, 100,000 in one night. And, of course, the atomic bombs. And there's not much more I can talk about. Well, let me say this. There's some really grisly facets to the Japanese story. And so far I haven't read about any of that in the German side. But American Marines, one of the pensions they had after a battle was chopping off Japanese heads, boiling the meat off the skulls, and then selling the skull, the polished skull, to American seamen. who didn't see a lot of land battling, so they would buy these ghoulish tokens of battle, the souvenirs of Japanese. And it was quite a lucrative industry going on, selling Japanese body parts. But that's what happens when you vilify and demonize your opponent. That's where words get people killed. You know, if I had another go at the subtitle to this book, it would probably be The Powerful Price of Propaganda and how words do get people killed. Words get people raped. Words get people tortured. Words count in war. And that's why we need to be much more guarded in what we call our enemies, because we send off these 18, 19, 20-year-old numbskulls, some of them about as sadistic and soulless as anything we can send off. Witness the characters at Abu Ghraib prison. And then we're surprised when they come back with heads and fingers and commit atrocities like Abu Ghraib, or rapes like occurs in Afghanistan or Iraq. We need to do a better job on that. If there's no other message, if even the people who hate my guts for writing this book, or people who are indifferent to it, God forbid, if only they can say, hey, propaganda has really gotten out of control, then my job is done. Of course, the propaganda didn't begin with World War II. It didn't begin with World War I, although it got a rolling start, let's say, in the 20th century. That's when mass communication became so instrumental in war. And then the wrong people, of course, got a hold of the media, and we're getting things like we are right now in the Middle East.
Right. Matt, you've been silent, holding your peace. Do you have any questions or thoughts you want to volunteer?
Yeah, I mean, I've just been fascinated listening to his accounts. A couple thoughts are you've written about the Plains Indians in another book of yours, and quite a bit on the frontier and stuff. So you're sort of in a position to contrast pre-propaganda, pre-civilized warfare versus the industrialized, hyper-civilized, if sort of post-civilized, if you will, warfare. I understand that both were quite grisly, but do you have any contrasts, any differences you see in the nature and style of the atrocities?
I go back to what I said when I began this interview with you guys. You certainly are the intellectual and spiritual epicenter of the white nationhood world, in my opinion. That's a very trenchant question you're asking. You know, and I've never thought about it until you just said it. It was refreshing, yes, now that you mention it. The lack of propaganda during the Indian Wars, the lack of it. Nevertheless, it was very, very vicious. And a lot of it, I've got to say, again, this is a book about the way it was, not the way we wanted it to be. That is the Indian Wars. Indians were some of the most sadistic people I've ever read about in my life, researched. Of course, their propaganda, I don't know what they said around the campfires. They didn't leave a written legacy. Maybe they said, I can't wait to cut this guy into inches when I get a hold of him tomorrow in the battle. Maybe that was their form of propaganda. But that's really interesting, Matt, you bring this up. Let me say this. I can say this. Let me preface this with a comment. Though I wrote one book on the Indian Wars, and though I wrote one book on the World War II, that doesn't necessarily make me an expert in either one of these wars. I am, however, an expert in these books. The scalp dance book you're mentioning about the Indian warfare on the plains is in the words, again, of the folks themselves. It's pretty hard to dismiss an account of a soldier who walks upon the scene of a massacre in which the women are staked out and raped to death, and then their throats cut when they're no longer any use, and babies brained on rocks, little tiny babies and kids who are crying, brained on rocks. When a soldier's describing that, you can very well understand why excesses did occur, and I suppose they were their own form of propaganda, if you will, the evidence of massacre and slaughter and rape and mayhem.
Well, I know through my own grandparents and great-grandparents, they would even relay stories from in southern Indiana, where I'm from, stories about the children being kidnapped and women being raped and that sort of thing. So, yeah, mm-hmm. whether it's war propaganda or you know, what have you, that's definitely always been a powerful, powerful thing.
You know, let me say this to you guys. You'll probably find this interesting. Sometimes history, 19th century history, especially the American Civil War, the Indian Wars, it seems like it occurred back in the Stone Age, back in the Iron Age. So far removed that there's no way we can be close to it. Well, let me say this. When I was researching the Indian War book, I actually did a live interview with a woman whose mother was captured by Indians in 1877.
Wow.
That's how close, yes. What are we talking about? Two generations removed right there. That close. Just a little side note I thought I'd throw in there. But anyway, some folks have there's been a few people, every once in a while they'll raise their heads and they'll say, this guy gets off on blood and guts, murder and mayhem. And, you know, I don't know if I can argue with what they say, because if you look at the books I've written, the first one was about travel abroad and living in Europe. But even my most recent book is about it's a true crime account about a young, beautiful mother who was abducted, raped, and murdered by some guy that had no rap sheet. I mean, this was a bolt out of the blue. A cop's daughter she was. So even that has the elements of violence in it. And some of my Lincoln books I've written, too, on that, yes, they're full of violence. So maybe I do get off on that. I don't think so. I've got to have some self-respect here.
Well, no, it's fascinating, and it's so important that this hellstorm, as far as, you know, and going back to my grandparents again, they grew up, they were a little bit too young for World War II, but they weren't too young to soak up the anti-Japanese propaganda. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they knew sort of on a cerebral, superficial level that we were now friends and they were human. But, mm-hmm. You know, once you get a kid that young and the alienness of the Japanese people, it's so easy. It was so easy to dehumanize them. And, you know, you tell a preteen girl out on the farm that these bizarre looking, nasty little critters are trying to kill your uncle and your mm-hmm. cousin. You know, you can't help but sort of understand the dehumanizing propaganda. I'm a huge admirer of the Japanese people as well. But the bizarre thing about World War II, though, is our World War II propaganda against the Germans didn't just sort of fade away the same way the Japanese. It metastasized into our collective national religion. It became... You know, if you were to take me and Greg and have me go to one side of town with a sandwich sign saying, I hate God, and Greg, we'd have Greg do this one, I wouldn't have the courage, and he'd have one that said, I hate Jews. Who do you think would last longer before somebody attacked one of us?
Great point. Yeah,
and if somebody gets mad, they don't say, if you get them angry enough, they don't say, well, you've got a devil in you. Or, you know, Bob, you're just satanic. I don't even, you know, it's no, Bob, you're a Nazi. You know, that's the worst thing you can be in the American psyche, you know, 70 years on from the war.
Good point. And you know something, Greg, too, you're bringing up, it occurs to me. That didn't happen with the American Indian Wars. They buried the hatchet. You know that term, bury the hatchet. Mm-hmm. As soon as the last hostile put down his bow and arrows, unlike World War II. You're right. And we both know the answer to that, all three of us. Let me say it just right out front. The Germans came within a whisker of winning that thing. And that scared the hell out of worldwide Jewry. And that's the reason we've got this going to this very day, because National Socialism is a very attractive political philosophy. It brings back manhood again. It's talking about independence and self-assuredness. It's a very attractive economical, political, spiritual philosophy.
That's
what scares them. That's what still scares them to this day. That's why, 70 years later, I mean, it's still the dirty, filthy Germans, these silly movies they've got coming out. But yes, I mean, you're really hitting some notes that's jogging my brain a little bit. I haven't thought of these things, and you know, today while they're still vilifying Germans in more indirect ways today than of course during and before and during the war. Well, for instance, today, tomorrow's Easter. I see also that the local Jewish synagogue is having a festival, a Holocaust festival. Not a festival, but a Holocaust Remembrance Day. Everybody's invited to come. I guess it hurts to not, you know, have the corner on religion or suffering or whatever you will. But right now, the guns are turned toward the propaganda. Guns are turned towards the Muslims. Muslims have become demonized and vilified. You know, I don't claim to be an expert in world politics. You guys are certainly people I would class as professionals who can have probably some very good answers in this. So correct me if I'm wrong. But right now, I feel as if, as I mentioned earlier, that the Muslims of the world have become the new Nazis of the world, and that there's nothing you can say bad enough about them. You can't kill enough of them. You cannot do enough bad things against them, just like World War II. Correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, because we've got some of the same things at play here. We don't like a certain country, say Iraq or Afghanistan, and we bomb them back to the Stone Age. In the case of Afghanistan, of course, that was pretty easy to do.
Yeah, with the Muslims, but, I mean, I do object to their immigration into Europe very strongly. But as far as the dehumanization of Muslims in the Middle East and the Jewish dehumanization of Muslim civilians, it is truly despicable, and it's in the same frame. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, and you see that locally, and it upsets me. It troubles me because, you know, as much as I'm supposedly like a racist or whatever, I just instinctively and intuitively don't like when ordinary people of any race or ethnicity are vilified. And you see that as far as like, yeah, we should just take Iran and turn it into a big a glass parking lot or whatever. Mm-hmm. just nuke those, nuke those Arabs. Not technically Arabs, but not that that's a distinction.
Right now it seems like the only people standing up against a worldwide Jew hegemony, and it's hard for me to. Let me say this. I agree with you. I think the Arab world, the Arabs should stay in the Arab world. I think the Europeans should stay in Europe. I don't like this open immigration that's going on in the Western world. But right now, they are being massacred, slaughtered, threatened, abused. And to me, it seems as if these are the only people now standing up against Jewish supremacy worldwide.
Well, what's powerful about your book in standing up against Jewish supremacy is, you know, there's been quite a bit of finger quote Holocaust denial or revisionism, and Lord knows that the Holocaust has been exaggerated and exploited and taken grossly out of context with people like Elie Wiesel declaring it historically, you know, a unique event, that genocide is sort of on a pedestal, and to even compare it or discuss it in, you know, alongside other atrocities like the ones you're discussing, it is simply intolerable to them. It is, you know, it's heresy to the actual religion of most Americans. They think they're Christians, but I think if they really reflected on what, you know, what they care about most deeply, they'll find that they're actually, you know, believe in Holocaustianity, if you will. Mm-hmm. And what's powerful about Hellstorm is it doesn't, you know, hug that tar baby of Holocaust revisionism, where you appear to be downplaying, you know, suffering. And I believe that, you know, plenty of what happened to the Jewish peasants on the Eastern Front was excessive, unnecessary, and unacceptable. I'm sure some of our more staunch listeners would take offense to that. But, you know, I think, rather than trying to minimize that, a better way to deconstruct this sort of secular religion, this sinister anti-religion, in my opinion, it is to show what you're showing here in Hellstorm, that no, we were not, you know, the supreme moral actors. We were also mass rapists. The Germans were, you know, had absolutely no monopoly whatsoever on dehumanizing other people, or, you know, just monstrosity in this god-awful Brothers War.
You know, again, I'm no expert on World War II. I only know what I read and research and basically what's in this book. Let me say this. As far as the Geneva Convention, the German army, the German military, the German government adhered much closer to the Geneva Convention than the Allies did. It's a fact that the International Red Cross reports that I think it's 96% of American and British POWs returned home healthy, safe and sound, which is almost better than they'd done if they'd been in their countries all by themselves, not even in war. Churchill wanted to douse Germany with poison gas, and his advisor said, let's don't do that because Germany has its own stock of poison gas they can douse us with. But nevertheless, Churchill wanted to do it. He was finally told no. Neutral Switzerland. It was bombed, not by the Germans, but by the Americans. Not once, not twice, at least three or four times. Probably to blast Germans who had sought refuge there toward the end of the war. But, again, it wasn't Germany who broke Switzerland's neutrality. It was the Americans invading Norway, invading Iceland, invading other countries. It wasn't the Germans that did it first. It was the Americans and Brits. The Germans, I'm sure there were excesses committed. I mean, let's face it, the libraries are full of such atrocity accounts. There's got to be some truth there. I have not become an expert on that, though. So what I'm talking about is what was done against the Germans and their allies, and then most of the civilians.
But that breaks the narrative right there.
Although I've read more than my share about the so-called Jewish Holocaust, even if it's actual, factual truth all the way through, what kind of people would turn such a terrible event into an industry, a multi-billion dollar annual industry, and then basically say all argument, all debate is off. It's verboten. You cannot talk about this. It would turn it, as Greg mentioned, into a state religion. That's very unbecoming, very seamy, very suspicious. But again, back to this, I'm no expert, so I cannot really talk with high authority. But it seems that the same things they accused the Germans of, the Jews were more than willing to commit against them at the end of the war. A lot of these torture chambers, especially behind the Soviet area of influence, was committed by Jews. Jews ran in some of the camps in Poland, many of the camps, as a matter of fact. As you can imagine, the Germans in these camps, of which I talk about, they were shown no mercy. Things like, were you a Nazi? And, of course, the guy says no, and he's hit over the head with a chair. He said, you liar, you pig. Go on down the line, you keep asking the same question, that is the Jewish interrogator, and they keep saying no, and finally, when they start saying yes, they still get hit because you're saying, you pig, that's for being a Nazi. The torture, the G2, which was intelligence in the American army, a lot of these folks were German immigrants who had fled Germany in the 30s and who had come back with a vengeance. They understood the language, they understood the culture, they understood the nuances of the German mind, so they were in a perfect position to, quote, interrogate. Actually, it was just sadistic torture, quite honestly. The war was over. There was very little information they'd get from these people. It was all about sadism and torture. And, that when I think about the torture, I do have a couple of chapters that it goes through that. And back to that complaint that I've gotten from several folks who make these offhanded comments about me getting off on torture and violence and blood. Maybe I do, like I said. But let me say this also. If Hellstorm is graphic to a sickening degree, I didn't do that. It's the people. This is what happened to those people. These things were done to these victims. A lot of times it's in their own words. It happened to them. It was committed against them. I'm not making this up or embellishing accounts for some sadistic pleasure.
Well, when I was a child in school, they showed us Holocaust movies. You know, they certainly don't hold back in any way, for decency's sake, resist the urge to colorfully describe and even embellish what happened to the Jewish people in World War II. And
they do it to children. It's child abuse, really.
Systematically.
It's systematic child abuse by the American educational system. And it's astonishing to me that parents across the country are not mad as hell about this and organizing to try and stop it. But I guess we know why that's the case. I think it's about time that we do wrap up. This has been a really, really enjoyable discussion. One of the things that strikes me about the Second World War and discussion of the Second World War is that it is almost entirely today carried on in terms of propaganda cliches. And the propaganda cliches are so obvious sometimes. For instance, people say, Adolf Hitler started World War II. Even I knew that just from looking at history books when I was in 10th grade. We were reading world history, and that was said, and I said, well, wait a second here. Hitler invaded Poland, right? It was the British and the French who declared war on him. It takes a world to have a world war. And yet, all the guilt is laid on Germany and its allies. And until we get over that, and until we start spreading the guilt and responsibility around a little bit and draining away some of this gross excesses of American self-righteousness, if that's even possible, given our psychology, I don't think we're going to be able to avoid World War III or World War IV. And so I think that what you're doing is really part of a larger project, which is an attempt to guard world peace. And I think that that's a tremendously important thing to do. So anyway, Tom, thank you so much. Matt, do you have any last questions for Tom?
No, I just want to make sure he gets his info out on how people can go about purchasing these books, especially Hellstorm.
Okay, I'd be happy to. Again, you can go through Amazon. I think they're $39 for the hardback. They'll get it to you the next day, Amazon.com. Or you can go through the publisher at Aberdeen Press. That's 303-795-1890. Just leave a message there and pay however, or you can go through me. I can sell you a softback at $25 or a hardback at $35, and that both prices include postage. And I've got a PayPal account. If you do, just drop the money into that account at MT Goodrich, M as in Michael, T as in Thomas, Goodrich at AOL.com, and I'll get a copy in the mail probably Monday, Tuesday, or whatever day. The day following your order, I'll try to get it in the mail. And, I'll sign the book for you. And, again, I hope whoever orders the book that they read it, and if necessary, read it again and never, ever forget it. And then I hope they do something. Rather than just put the book away, I hope they do something, whether it's a letter to an editor or contributing to wonderful websites, publishers like Countercurrents Publishing. I know you guys can always use the money, and you do great work. And, boy, if we lose these lights, the world gets dark very quickly. So I encourage everyone, if you don't buy my book, contribute, do something, write a letter, give some money to your favorite political cause, whether it's Countercurrents or another upright group.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for that. One of the things that I would really recommend that people do is if they read this book and like it, they buy 5 more copies and hand it out to their friends. It's a very, very handsomely produced hardcover. It makes a great gift. Yeah, it's a somber and terrifying story, but it's a story that needs to be told. I remember one time a minister that I knew who was a chaplain for the U.S. military was going on about the Iraq war, and he said, you've got to understand, Americans are good people. And I said to him, Well, how does this fit in with the theology that you supposedly accept, namely about original sin and so forth? And he got all upset with me because Americans really have this deep sense of righteousness and goodness and good intentions. And it's that very conviction that we're so good and that we're doing the world a favor that leads us to behave so savagely when these ungrateful people don't accept the light that we're trying to bring them. And so I think that part of American savagery really has to do with American exceptionalism and an American sense of, you know, we're basically on the side of the angels at all times. No one ever has any good reason to resent us or to want to attack us. And therefore, if people do, well, you know, we feel totally righteous in behaving in a really savage way towards them. And books like Hellstorm, I think, go a long way to trying to helping Americans realize that we're just human with all the bad things that entails, too. But I think that coming to grips with our own humanity, including our own potential for evil, actually will make us less evil in the future. And that's a very good thing.
You know, Greg, also, I'm not so naive as to think that me and my book is going to change the world. I'm going to continue to work as if it were, but I don't think we're going to have any radical departure from the past and the present until the day comes and America really gets into a real war and has their teeth thoroughly kicked out to the point that the word war is not even whispered 1,000 years after the defeat. And that's all I'm seeing right now. That's the only thing I'm seeing. It's a terrible Armageddon look at the future. But that's the reason I'm promoting this book. That's the reason I'm on your program. Maybe we can avoid that. Maybe one more drop into the lake will break the dam. That's the premise I'm working under. One more drop might break that dam and let the water flow.
Well, I think everybody should think that way too and not get intimidated by the vastness of it. There's a poster that I like from this company called Demotivators, which is a company that sells parodies of those motivational posters you see up in corporate cubicles. And my favorite Demotivators poster is called Teamwork, and it shows a snowball rolling down a hill gathering size, and it says a few harmless flakes coming together can unleash an avalanche of destruction. And that's what I like to think of us as, a few harmless mm-hmm. flakes maybe sticking together and unleashing an avalanche of truth. So, Tom, thank you so much for joining us in Countercurrents Radio, and I'm sure that this will be one of our most popular broadcasts.
Well, thank you, Matt, and Greg, both of you guys. You're wonderful.
Our pleasure.